Hi guys, welcome to the 10th MHP podcast. We're finally hitting the double digits. Today we'll be talking about PRI modalities, when to train compound movements in a workout, as well as plyometrics. So today we're super excited because we finally hit the double digits. How do you feel, Jacob?
Feeling great. We're in the big time, big leagues now.
Exactly. All right, so the first topic, what are PRI modalities and what are they specifically used in training?
So this opens up a very deep rabbit hole. I've kind of learned about this stuff peripherally from other people that have chased that rabbit hole all the way down. And my understanding is that there's a whole bunch of courses and certifications around this stuff. And sometimes you take one or two of them and you leave feeling like you knew less than when you went in there. So I'll preface all of this by saying it's a very nuanced, complicated world of topics that I am a very slight, I'm very slightly educated on them. So the PRI experts, if any happen to listen to this, will not be happy by anything I have to say, I'm sure, but we'll see what happens. So essentially, my understanding is PRI is this view on the training and on the body that essentially views it through what's called the left AIC pattern, which just means the left anterior and interior chain is overactive. That probably makes no sense at this point. So what that means or how it presents is because we are naturally asymmetrical in our physiology, and I believe what they claim is that this all starts with our lungs because we have this pesky thing called our liver, which eats up where our lungs are maybe meant to be. So our lungs are actually out of balance. We have more lung on one side than the other. And if you can imagine how, when our lungs expand and contract, that plays a really big role in our posture and our movement, because whether our rib cage is expanded or compressed, like that changes how the shoulder is set up and how the hips are moved. Like the breathing on its own can be a whole rabbit hole in how movement works alongside our breathing. So because our lungs and our organs, and therefore our breathing, is asymmetrical, what you end up with is postures and movement patterns that are very asymmetrical. So they call it the left AIC pattern because that is what they say. And to be honest, I see it myself and I see it in a lot of other people. It does appear to be a very common occurrence, is you get the orientation that you end up with is a pelvis that's slightly shifted to the left because the left side hip flexor and adductor and quad are a little bit overactive. So your left hip is a little bit flexed and it tilts the pelvis slightly towards the right. When that happens, the upper body, the torso, slightly tilts to the left.
To try and like compensate almost.
It kind of to balance things out. Yeah. You get a left shoulder that's usually slightly higher, and then a neck that's slightly tilted towards that elevated shoulder and then rotated slightly to the left.
You have me checking now in my video to see
So
which one is lower or higher.
the we'll get a little later into the problems with some of this, but essentially the whole idea of PRI is to try to bring us a little more into neutral, to essentially fight against some of these asymmetries. And because of that, most of the exercises that they use and things like that, you only do on one side. Because if you're a little bit twisted this way, you don't need to do exercises that are going to further bring you that way. You're just looking to come to center. So that is my very surface level PRI intro.
And so, considering all these aspects, and especially wanting to train kind of the opposite side, When is it actually beneficial to use in training, and how can you actually use it?
Yeah, so a lot of their exercises have to do with, it's a little hard to imagine, but essentially trying to activate the right hip, and sort of like the left obliques. Like if you imagine, they do a lot of kind of reaching exercises. So if you imagine like laying on your back and having your left arm up, and you're just trying to almost flex your abs to rotate you, a little bit in that opposite direction. And the thing that I'm a little less educated on is how they incorporate the breathing into some of these things too. But sort of the joke that comes out around PRI is it's all breathing into balloons. I guess they do a lot of breathing stuff with basically like a balloon in your mouth as a feedback mechanism. So that's kind of the way that it's used. Essentially the way that I view it is, and the reason it's a little bit controversial is there's people that have pursued this pathway to its furthest extent. And from the outside looking in, it seems like what happens sometimes is everything becomes a corrective exercise. So you show up at the gym and you're doing an hour of trying to bring your body into center. And what you aren't doing a lot of is actually training. Now, I'm sure that would make, go
So it's
ahead.
almost like you're just like correcting the asymmetries rather than actually training anything specifically.
Yeah, like, you know, if you came in and said, hey, I'm a basketball player that wants to jump higher, and you know, you have all these athletic goals. Not all, because I also know and follow some very good practitioners that implement this stuff into a training program that chases the goal and, you know, makes it part of the process. But I'm sure there are also people out there where if you came saying, hey, I want to jump higher, you'd end up doing an hour of laying on your back, flexing your right adductor and breathing into a balloon. And that's where people kind of make fun of it and say, this is not the right way to go about things. So as with everything, it kind of depends on how it gets implemented, how you're using it, and the greater context of things. So my thing is like, it seems like a useful tool. It takes it's not something that's all that easy to take and kind of practice on your own, because there's a lot of nuance with what muscles you're using to create these like during these exercises. But
It takes a lot of knowledge, definitely.
yeah, it's a complicated thing. So I mean, there's some I wouldn't have their like handles off the top of my head, but definitely there's some people I could share that I follow on Instagram that do a pretty good job of trying to explain it in a simple fashion. And then how it relates to, you know, taking this into performance and not just spending an hour laying on your back.
Yeah, exactly. And kind of relating this also to other training methods, like for example, training compound movements and single muscle involved movements. I know that's also very specific to how you divide it up. So why is it important to actually train compound movements before accessory or single muscle involved movements instead of the other way around?
Yeah, so basically the more muscles that are involved, or the more joints, you could view it that way. Like if it's, you know, your hip, knee, and ankle, for a squat, for example, it's like your ankle, your knee, your hip, and the entirety of your spine is all sort of active and involved. So there's a very large energy demand because a lot of muscles are working. There's a lot of coordination involved. And these are things that fatigue is going to make it a lot more challenging. If you go and do an isolated quad exercise and then try to squat, you now have essentially a weak, fatigued link in the chain, as well as just having some general kind of neurological or energetic fatigue that then takes away from an exercise that essentially demands all of your resources if done at a high intensity. So you definitely want to rank things from most complex, most joints involved, most intensity kind of given to as the front side of your workout or your training program.
Right. For the first things you do.
Yeah. And it's on the flip side, it's easy to go from doing a heavy squat to getting into a leg extension machine and training the quads because there's almost no coordination involved, no balance, no stability, no skill. It's just an isolated position for your muscles to just do work.
Right. And so, for example, if you had like a split squat, a leg extension, a hamstring curl, and let's even throw in there an RDL, how would you actually organize that into the program? Because they kind of all use different muscles, different amount of muscles too.
So I'm going to give you two answers depending on the goal of the session.
Right.
So if I had these four exercises lined up and I was really wanting to get a strong stimulus from my split squat, I would do my split squat first. And let's say for the sake of this, I'm going to do a really heavy round of four reps on my split squat. So I'm really pushing the weight and the intensity there. I then move into the RDL because I would put the split squat and the RDL as the top for most complex and top of the line for where you'd want to start.
Right.
And then this is where maybe some people aren't thinking about this as an aspect of their program. But because I'm going split squat, which is very quad dominant, and then RDL, which is posterior chain, glute and hamstring dominant, I then follow that with leg extension and then hamstring curl. So you're alternating between kind of like a quad hamstring.
Right.
It's going to give you more rest for the muscle group in between, which means you're going to be able to put more into those accessory exercises at the end. So that would be scenario number one.
Okay.
Scenario number two, if my main focus for the day was the RDL and I wanted to be able to put more into that, I would just put that first.
Okay.
Then you're not getting any limitations from any carryover fatigue from the split squat. And now those two exercises don't share a lot of muscle groups that are being worked. So when I say
they're kind of different.
Yeah. So when I say the fatigue that carries over, that's more so just general, how much energy you got left in the tank, neurological fatigue, which absolutely plays a role when you've got a really intense exercise in your program. So that's where the priorities kind of shift. So if the RDL was the number one thing I was chasing, I'd put that first, followed by the split squat, and then I'd flip the accessories and I'd go hamstring curl and then leg extension. So you're still getting that hamstring quad alternating back and forth.
Yeah, and like enough rest between them.
Exactly. So that's how you would get the most out of those four exercises.
Awesome. And the last method that we'll be talking about today is actually plyometrics. It's very commonly used, but just for the people who don't really know, what are plyometrics and how are they actually implemented into a training routine for an athlete?
Plyometrics are basically anything that's done with kind of like a repetitive, fast elastic component. The most common example is jumps, but I put sprinting and speed work in the plyometric bucket. And then medicine ball exercises can also slide in there because people forget that your upper body can be fast, explosive, and athletic as well. So anything that falls into those buckets is your plyometrics. And for athletes, that's going to be a very, if not the most important part of your program, depending on kind of training age and time of the year, things like that. In season, you want to be careful about overloading certain things. So for example, in basketball, you're getting a lot of little jumps and cuts and things like that. So doing some sort of cutting side to side drill is essentially doubling up on things you're going to get from practice and games anyways, but you don't often get a true low fatigue max effort jump or sprint as an example, because in a practice or game setting, you're dealing with fatigue, you're dealing with chaotic situations. You don't get the space to really go give a maximal output into a jump or a sprint. Plus, a basketball court is, compared to things like soccer and field sports, it's a small space. Usually you're not able to get to top speed.
Yeah,
so,
it's more controlled.
Yeah, so training, giving yourself the context to train a max effort jump, a max effort sprint, get to top speeds, that's where you're going to get the most out of in-season programming because it's inherently different from what you're seeing in practice. Whereas in the off-season, there's almost an aspect of trying to mimic what you're going to see from practices and games because you're trying to prepare the body to handle those things. So that's where you don't want to be redundant in your plyometric programming.
Yeah, and you know, kind of for the physiology heads that listen to this podcast, plyometrics, they use the stretch shortening cycle.
Yes.
I guess we should just go over a little bit of what that is, why it's so important, and why it's actually trained.
Absolutely. That's a great point. So when you are trying to produce force into some movement, doing it slow, for example, just take a squat. If you take a slow tempo squat where you're going down slow, pausing, moving up slow, that's almost entirely a muscular driven movement. And all the energy that's created is energy you had to spend to create that force.
Right.
The stretch shortening cycle that you mentioned is essentially where the free energy comes from. So if you go, yes. So if you do a jump, what's happening is the muscles, same muscles involved in the squat, are still working to produce force, but you also have the tendons and the fascia and all the elastic fibers throughout your legs that are taking the energy from your descent, the free energy that comes from gravity, and then like a rubber band springing you back the other way. So there's all this free energy to be had from your tendons and fascia and all these other things. And it's something that everyone can utilize. Like you're going to be able, everyone knows or can picture now that if they do an exercise, a strength exercise fast, they're going to be able to use more weight than if they go slow and controlled because you're able to utilize that free energy store. But most people, unless it's been trained, their tendons and all these elastic tissues don't have a really high stress tolerance. So you're not able to get as much of that free energy as you potentially could. So that's why these plyometrics, like I said, are going to be top of the food chain for importance in your program. It's because training these fast elastic movements is going to build up the tendons and the fascia and all these elastic tissues to handle more force, give you back more free energy. And essentially just what the result is just a general feeling of feeling more springy.
Right.
Like you can hit the ground and spring back off of it a lot easier than you could before.
And outside of just kind of the springiness, what are the other noticeable impacts of training plyos from a performance standpoint? So kind of what does it translate to without being too sport specific?
Yeah, just a general ability to jump higher, cut faster, sprint faster, like the
So be more explosive in vertically and horizontally
in all movements. Yes, as long as you're training, like there's an aspect where if you get better at jumping, you might see some transfer to sprinting, but there is a specificity component where you need to train going forward to get more explosive going forward, and same with verticality. Like there is a general enhancement that you'll see, but mostly you want to make sure you're training the specific things that you want to get better at.
Does it also apply in terms of like the upper body versus the lower body? is it also as specific as that? Because I know you mentioned that, for example, with the med ball, you're actually able to use that for the upper body, and then maybe for the lower body, it would be like box jumps, leaps, hops, quick feet, sprinting.
Yeah, for sure. If you have a sport where being able to move explosively through your upper body is important, there's maybe not as many.
Right.
But say, so the easy example is you could take something like boxing, where that would be a big one. Obviously, throwing sports like baseball or like a quarterback in football, would that like the, that's the most obvious, like you need to be able to produce power through your arm and your upper body.
Right.
But even taking a maybe less obvious example, in basketball, could you develop your ability to throw a longer pass, throw a harder pass? These are things you like, you can train that ability to just to produce more force through your arms. And I know in basketball, everyone's just thinking like, I want to jump higher, but there's other athletic qualities that actually do transfer to some of the skills involved.
Yeah, that's super cool. And you know, if somebody wants to kind of train this over time, and actually see if they're improving or not, what is one variable that they can actually test to see how they were performing before and then after a training program that used plyometrics?
I would do two things. The first would be just a simple measure of output for the thing that you're specifically training for. Like we talked about vertical and horizontal. If you're focused on vertical jump, do a vertical jump test. If you're focused on getting faster, do a sprint test and get some external measure of performance.
Right.
That's the simplest thing to do, maybe the obvious thing to do. The less obvious thing, which could potentially be more important, I'll just throw that out there.
Yeah. Hot take, hot take.
Would be some sort of qualitative measure, something that you can't, other unless you have some really expensive technology, something you can't really get a measure on.
Right.
But if you did something like a pogo hop, where you're just bouncing off 2 feet, you're one, trying to get high off the ground, and two, trying to be fast off the floor.
Yeah, so like if, reduce contact time on the floor.
Exactly. If you do that exercise and you set up your phone to take a video where you don't need to get the whole exercise, if you can just see from like your knee down and you can see what the foot's doing, if you take a video of that and you can compare it to day one to day 60 of your explosiveness, plyometric program, whatever you're doing, you would hope to see that, hopefully you'd see both, that you're able to get higher and be faster off the floor. But either one of those things happening would also be progress, because you can, those are two variables that you can trade off, even in the same session without improving anything. You could increase your time on the ground to create more force and jump higher, and you could decrease your jump height to be faster off the floor. So usually what you see is like, if you're just optimizing for speed off the ground, it's little low hops. And then if you're optimizing for getting as high as possible, you spend a lot more time on the ground to generate force. So either one of those things improving without the other dropping would be a, I would say, proof that something's gotten better. But with a really robust program, hopefully you would see both of those things are able to increase. And then that's something that you would hope you could pick up on a video, where you don't have a number associated, but your proof is it's right there.
Yeah, so it's like just noticeable results that you can just see without needing to rent out or use some very expensive equipment.
Absolutely.
Awesome. All right, so that brings us to the end of our 10th episode. Thank you so much, Jacob, as always. And make sure to tune in next week, guys, for the next episode. Thank you so much.
Thank you. See ya.
See ya.